Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Weather and Bitcoin and Greece, oh my, it has been an interesting day in capitalism today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Weather Report for Monday, the 26th of January. Good as always to have you with us. We will have snow, continued snow until I don't even know when. It is, in a word, ugly up and down the northeastern seaboard of this country. It's a misery perhaps most concentrated in airports from New York to Boston and points in between. According to the website FlightAware.com, there have been 6,800 cancellations today and tomorrow, counting, I should probably add there, because there will be more coming. Airlines started grounding flights as early as yesterday, before the flakes even started falling. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson starts us off today with a look into how and when those decisions are made.
Martha Sherman was supposed to fly from New York to San Francisco tomorrow morning. Not happening.
I didn't think that it would have already been canceled, but that's what I discovered and started calling immediately about 11 o'clock last night.
She was on hold till 1 a.m. and was finally rebooked this afternoon after taking her complaint to Twitter, of all places. Not exactly a pleasant experience, but it could be worse. Daryl Jenkins is the chairman of the American Aviation Institute. He says the airlines don't want Martha stuck in the airport or on a plane.
Because you have a forecast a day in advance. What you're doing is trying to make the recovery as orderly as possible. Rebooking and all of that is not pleasant, but it is more orderly than it is elsewise.
When a storm's coming in, the airlines have a tough choice to make. If they cancel too early, they can get stuck on the ground while their competitors are in the air. But if they wait too long, they may have to divert planes, stranding passengers, crew, and equipment in random cities.
You would then have to move those airplanes to try to reestablish a schedule.
Bob Mann is an airline consultant and a former executive with American, Pan Am, and TWA.
So you waste money because airplanes and crews cost money by the minute when they're flying, or in many cases when they're not flying.
By canceling ahead of time, Mann says the airlines can move planes away from the snow. That helps them be more nimble and allows them to get back to a normal schedule faster once the storm passes. And since this is a relatively slow travel period, they'll likely be able to rebook passengers on existing flights over the next few days. So, all in all, the airlines might lose some revenue, but canceling early keeps costs from piling up with the snow. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The weather in Athens, Greece today was low 50s, a little bit of rain. Not enough, though, to put a damper on celebrations by the far-left Syriza party, whose leader, Alexis Tsipras, was sworn in as that country's new prime minister this morning. The election yesterday was fought over austerity and what it means for growth and how far Greek creditors in Northern Europe, which is to say Germany, can be pushed by a new Greek government intent on rolling back some of the budget cuts and economic reforms imposed in return for multi-billion dollar bailouts. So the question, of course, is now what happens? From Athens, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that.
Triumphant Alexis Tsipras, leader of the left-wing Syriza party, promised the Greeks he would now end the pain and humiliation of the budget cuts. And he broke into English to send the same message to the rest of the European Union.
Our common future in Europe is not the future of austerity. It's the future of democracy, solidarity and cooperation.
Syriza believes that it will throw off the yoke of German-inspired austerity. John Milios, the party's chief economist, says other heavily indebted southern European countries will rise up too and follow suit.
Change in Greece is going to be the beginning of a change all over Europe, starting, of course, from the south, where the problems are bigger.
Spain, Portugal and Italy will jump on the anti-austerity bandwagon and gang up on the Germans, claims Syriza. George Katrouglas, a member of the European Parliament for the party, says don't blame Greece if the EU falls apart.
It could break up, but it would break up not because of us, but because of the German persistence on policies that they have clearly failed.
But not everyone sees Syriza as a dynamic new force leading the charge against Germany's crippling rigidity, nor as a new broom which will sweep away corruption and pork barrel politics at home.
They appear to be something new.
But they're not.
But they're not.
John Loulis, leading Greek political analyst, is not impressed with Syriza's people, or Greek politicians generally.
The people who get involved in politics are the pits, who, if they were not in politics, would be unemployed.
Many Syriza activists come from the Greek public sector, he sniffs, not a guarantee of efficiency or dynamism. As the new government prepares to do battle over austerity on the European stage, millions of Greeks will be hoping that this time Loulis is wrong. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, other than the snow, not a whole lot of anything, to be honest. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been talking currency quite a bit on the broadcast lately, the strength of the dollar and the correlated weakness of the euro, not to mention the Russian ruble, again in trouble today, by the way. Today, though, was a big day for cryptocurrency. I'm talking here about Bitcoin, the virtual currency that pretty much lives in our computers or on our phones. What happened today was the launch of the first major U.S.-based licensed exchange for trading Bitcoins. It's called Coinbase and is run by, it won't surprise you to hear, a Silicon Valley startup of the same name. The company has gotten its exchange off the ground with $100 million in backing from some quite respectable banks and venture capitalists and the New York Stock Exchange itself, for that matter. It will let money managers and investors and merchants and regular people who have used Bitcoins stashed online buy and sell them with a degree of security and reliability that has been so far lacking for this brave new currency. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Bitcoin. It's the leading digital currency in the world right now. It's not backed by any government or central bank. It allows people to buy and sell things, to send value via the internet. But how much value? That's a problem.
Bitcoin is a very volatile currency.
Jeff Brito runs Coin Center, a nonprofit policy group that supports the new technology.
It's traded from pennies per Bitcoin when it first began in 2009 to a high of about $1,200 or $1,300.
You'll get about $300 for a Bitcoin today.
I would not put money into Bitcoin that I couldn't afford to lose. It's in many ways a speculative bet if you're going to hold it for a long term.
And banks and hedge funds surely feel the same, especially with stories of Bitcoin exchanges like Mt. Gox in Japan mysteriously going belly up. Now enter Coinbase's new exchange, backed by banks, venture capital firms, and the New York Stock Exchange. Campbell Harvey teaches finance at Duke University.
We've got this respected exchange that's in the U.S., that isn't in Slovenia or someplace in Japan. They will provide a benchmark for pricing and presumably lead to lower volatility.
And Harvey says more acceptance by financial institutions and consumers in time.
Given that Bitcoin is still a nascent technology, a lot of people don't fully understand it or trust it. This gives a degree of comfort.
And Harvey says, as Bitcoins become more accepted, consumers will benefit from the virtual currency's high level of cybersecurity and lower payment costs. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One thing Mitchell didn't get to in his story, the sound of Bitcoins. Because come on, what is more recognizable than the sound of regular coins jingling in somebody's pocket? That, true story, is how I used to know my boss was coming down the hallway. Anyway, we've got a link to a site where you can hear, that's with air quotes, Bitcoins as they get traded. It is on our homepage, marketplace.org. There was an announcement from the Department of Health and Human Services today that will bring big changes to healthcare spending in this country, and sooner rather than later, too. Secretary Sylvia Matthews-Burwell said she is going to change the way the federal government reimburses Medicare providers. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein from the Health Desk is here to break it down for us. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so you got the headlines. What does this mean with some specificity here? What did Secretary Burwell do?
Well, what we're seeing is that the way the doctors and hospitals get paid by the federal government is going to change. I mean, this is really kind of like health reform 2.0. Hmm. The first step was to expand insurance, right? The Affordable Care Act. We all know about that. Yeah. The second step, and we saw this with Massachusetts, was to try and control costs. So today, what HHS is saying is that by the end of 2016, 85% of its budget's going to be tied to outcomes. Right now, you've got this thing that you know and I know all about. It's called fee-for-service. So every time we walk into the doctor's office and they do a physical or send us for an MRI or a test, the doctor gets paid for that. What HHS wants to do is by the end of 2016, 85% of its budget, so we're talking billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, is going to be tied not to just those tests, but to the actual outcomes. And so am I getting healthier? And the healthier I am as the patient, the more the doctor is going to get paid. So you're going to do away with this fee-for-service thing, and you're going to go more towards an outcome-based way of paying doctors and hospitals.
Medicare is huge, right? As you said, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. As Medicare goes, so goes healthcare spending, right? I mean, what's the bigger impact going to be, do you think?
Right. I mean, this is historic, and I think people need to understand that what is happening today could potentially have a much bigger impact on our healthcare spending over the long term than anything the Affordable Care Act ever does. The Affordable Care Act was aimed at doing one thing, which was really expanding insurance for people. What today is all about is trying to figure out how do you control costs. So everybody's like concerned about how much they're spending every month for insurance, how much they're spending when they go to the doctor. Today is all about that. And what people need to understand is what Medicare does really sets the table for the entire industry. So oftentimes, whatever the federal government does, the private insurers, private industry usually follows.
What does this mean for me, though, if I'm a patient? Is this going to be transparent to me? Is it a doctor-only thing? What's the deal?
I think it is. I mean, that's a great question. Look, it's going to really make a difference in a couple of different ways, Kai. Like, if you get into the hospital, Kai, and you're sick, right, and you walk into the hospital and they discharge you, it used to be like, they'd just be like, Kai, see you later, hope you're well, you know, and you're like, okay, thanks, dude. Now, under this, it's more going to be like, okay, Kai, we need to make sure you're doing okay. So we're going to call you. We're going to check up and make sure you're all right. There's going to be a level of kind of coordinated care. There's going to be a level of attention paid to you that you probably haven't gotten before, right? It also, though, could mean, Kai, that say you hurt your knee, right? You like to exercise. Yeah. You hurt your knee and you really want that MRI. Well, that costs money. And the doctor gets paid to keep costs down. So they might be like trying to say, you know what, we're not going to do an MRI. Let's give it a couple of weeks and see if you're really still hurting.
Dan Gorenstein at the health desk at WHYY. I always call my doctor dude, by the way, Dan. All right, be good. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott.
Coming up.
The cost doesn't make any difference to me. You can't put a price on the value of saving these images.
Priceless, you might say, but first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not a whole lot going on at the corner of Wall Street and Broad and Lower Manhattan, minus the snow. The Dow Industrial's up 6 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 17,678. The NASDAQ bumped up 13 points, that's a 3%, ended things at 4771. The S&P 500 climbed 5 points. That's 0.25%, finished at 2057. Tech giant Microsoft moved down to 3% today after its second quarter profits fell. That was in line with expectations. Seagate Technology sailed down 7.25% after projecting quarterly revenue that trailed analyst estimates. D.R. Horton chipped up 5.5% today. America's biggest home builder by revenue posted better than expected first quarter profits. Sales and orders were up as well. Rival PulteGroup went up 2.5%. Ocwen Financial, one of the country's biggest mortgage servicers, pumped up 8.8% today. California regulators are dropping action to suspend its license to operate in the state after the company agreed to pay a $2.5 million penalty. Bond prices today? Yeah, we got them. Yield on the 10-year T-note up slightly, 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes and durable goods orders for December. The Federal Reserve opens a two-day meeting on interest rates, and it's National Chocolate Cake Day, making Tuesday a special occasion. Or not. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Much has been made over the slowing growth rate of the Chinese economy, which came in last week at a quite subdued, for them, 7.4%. Overnight out of Shanghai, though, came this. The mayor of China's most dynamic economic engine said he is not going to target a specific GDP growth rate this year, shooting instead for economic quality and efficiency. Given the global importance of the Chinese economy and the questionableness of their economic statistics, it is an interesting development. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz is on the line from Shanghai. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
I said in the setup to this interview that it was interesting. What I really should have said was this is a big, big deal.
It really is a big deal. And it was really surreal to hear the mayor of China's wealthiest city start his speech off by saying, "We're not too concerned about GDP." For a mayor to say something like that even 5 years ago would have been political suicide, because for the past couple of decades, GDP growth has been the be-all, end-all obsession for China's government. But as you mentioned, China's growth has slowed. Mm. So, of course, there's a propaganda value in all of this. It makes it convenient for Chinese officials to suddenly not care about a number that isn't so high anymore. But perhaps an even more important reason here is that there's a new sheriff in town. President Xi Jinping has taken charge by going after corrupt officials and by vowing to reform China's economic growth model. And this appears to be part of that pledge.
Walk me through it then. How does this change away from GDP targeting, basically, help China in the long run?
Well, up until now, if you were a local government official in China, GDP growth numbers for your city or province were the top criteria for a promotion within the party. And you would accomplish that by building infrastructure. So you had a situation where local leaders were doing whatever it took to build. You know, they seized land from their residents to build shopping malls and high-rises. They accepted bribes from developers. They cooked the books to make themselves look better. And they built a lot of infrastructure that will never be used. So by shifting away from this model, Xi Jinping seems to want to ensure that local officials are instead focused and evaluated on qualitative targets like raising people's living standards, improving health care, and focusing on cleaning up their environment.
Yeah, other than that last one, though, the environment, right? I mean, these are necessarily difficult things to measure.
They are, and it's a conundrum for China because, you know, without tackling these big problems like the environment and the income gap, China's not going to be able to maintain this pace of economic growth in the future. So how do you do that in a slower growth environment where you can't spend as much as you're used to spending? You know, the key here, I think, is efficiency, making every renminbi, that would be China's mm-hmm. currency, of course, go as far as it can to improving people's lives. Up until now, a lot of government spending has been inefficient and wasteful, only benefiting the rich and the powerful. And it's important to remember here that China's economy is not imploding. You know, we're still looking at growth here above 7%. Making this 7% go further for everyone in China is what the government now seems to be focused on.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Guy.
Dish Network is going to roll out something tomorrow called Sling TV. It is, sadly, invitation only for now. Mere mortals like us will be able to get the streaming service next month, I'm told. It's all about the latest iteration of companies going over the top, is the catchphrase. You may want to take note of it because you're going to be hearing it a lot. CBS has done it. NBC is doing it. There's HBO Go, and the big cable guys are catching on as well. But Dish has something none of the others do, ESPN Live. Nova Sappho has the latest on the ever-changing nature of television and how we get it.
Here's what Dish is selling. For $20 a month, you get 12 channels. Forget the other 10 for a minute, and maybe even the 11th, CNN. Sling is streaming ESPN Live. Glenn Hauer, a research analyst at Park Associates, says live sports is the type of content that is key to building a streaming audience.
Content offering is going to be of pretty high importance to the consumer.
And Hauer says 20% of cable households with broadband say sports is a big reason why they subscribe to pay TV. So what are some reasons they don't subscribe? Some don't think they need it or can't pay for it, says Laura Martin. She's a senior cable and media analyst at Needham & Company.
The young people just don't really see the relevance of TV. The elderly, they watch more TV than any other demographic. But if they can't afford it, they can't afford it.
Tony Lenoir is a cable TV analyst at SNL Kagan. He says Sling TV, with its $20 monthly charge for live streaming, could be a game changer.
I think this whole thing could trigger a price war and obviously have an impact on multi-channel subscriptions.
That hasn't been lost on big media companies like ABC and CBS and cable outlets like HBO. They're all running or planning standalone streaming services. Lenoir says eventually all TV providers will have to offer some kind of pared-down streaming package.
Dish and others realize that and that there's no turning back, so they're adapting their business model.
Of course, Lenoir adds, all that streaming TV takes costly bandwidth, and cable companies are still the biggest internet service providers. In New York, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
I was poking around online the other day, and I came across a video of a guy in Boise, Idaho, talking about how he had bought at auction 31 rolls of undeveloped film from 70 years ago, World War II, as it turned out. And as I was watching that video, a thought came to me. So we called him up so I could ask him about it. His name is Levi Bettweiser, and he is the founder of something called the Rescued Film Project. Levi, it's good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Did you know when you got your hands on these rolls that you had something special?
I knew that I potentially had something special. Just from the look of the rolls themselves and what was written on them, I knew that they could potentially have some quite amazing photos on them. But you never know what you're going to get because obviously you have no idea what the condition of the images might be that are still on the film.
What was written on the canisters, by the way? What did they say?
Well, about half the rolls had handwritten notes of potentially what was on the rolls, and they're more so locations like Le Havre Harbor, Lucky Strike Camp, Boston Harbor. One was labeled Roll of French Funeral, and so we were able to actually recover some funeral pictures of a French officer on that roll.
Huh. The thing that got me about this project and about the video was that this is an industry, right? Film developing and actual film photography that almost doesn't exist anymore. I mean, yes, people will shoot on film, you know, at the high end and stuff, but everybody's all digital now. And this is a process and a thing, a business that's kind of going away.
Yeah, and it really is. And honestly, film photography has kind of more so turned from the standard for commercial and has now kind of turned more into more of an art medium for more stylized kind of art photography, if that makes sense. It's not as widely used, obviously, because of digital. And yeah, it is definitely, the industry is definitely lacking, but I think there is kind of a revival and a movement currently to kind of hold on to that. And film photography actually now, I feel like it definitely is on the upswing.
But your children, though, I mean, your grandkids, are they going to be doing the Rescued Memory Card Project, right? I mean, does that analogy apply?
That's not the first time we've been asked that question. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, but really the unique nature of the Rescued Film Project is that no one has ever seen the images before, not even the photographer. And so you kind of lose that unique nature when you pull an SD card out of a camera, assuming that the images could have already been printed or obviously they're seen instantly as soon as they're taken.
This comes, I imagine, the Rescued Film Project and your interest and the value you put in finding these images, it comes at no small cost. I mean, how much do you spend, I don't know, every year on developer and solutions and buying the film?
Yeah, well, the Rescued Film Project, I started it about 2 years ago, so it's only been in existence for about 2 years, and it's only been public about 6 months. And everything is personally funded by myself, and this is not my full-time job. I obviously have a full-time job sustaining myself. But over the last year and a half, 2 years, I have spent several thousand dollars of my personal funds to fund the project just because I believe in it, and it's a passion project, and the cost doesn't make any difference to me. You can't put a price on the value of saving these images.
Must make you crazy knowing that in the back of dresser drawers and in attics and in closets all over the country are rolls of film just sitting there.
Yeah, it makes me crazy, and it makes me very excited, too. But, yeah, I'll be talking to someone about the Rescued Film Project who's never heard about it before, and inevitably, after about 2 minutes, they will stop, pause, get a question look on their face, and then they'll say, you know, I think I have about 10 rolls that I shot like 20 years ago in the bottom of a cabinet, and that happens 9 times out of 10. And, yeah, I mean, as much searching as we can do, we can never look far and wide enough by ourselves. So it's really people sending us rolls of film that will keep continuing to fuel the project.
It is the Rescued Film Project. Levi Bettweiser runs it, and he funds it as well. We've got a link to it on our website, and you should check out that video. It's up on Vimeo. We'll have a link to that at marketplace.org. Levi, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, a nod to the millions slipping and sliding on roads all across the greater Northeast. First of all, turn down the radio and concentrate on driving, will you? Oh, man. All right. Also, this, all that salt and brine and sand that is being sprayed on the roads and highways today is more expensive than it was this time last year. Statewide, in the Empire State alone, that leaves out Wisconsin and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, every place, the average price of road salt hit $58 a ton last fall. That is up almost a third over a year earlier. All right, on a very quiet day on Wall Street, the Dow up 6 points today, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ up 13 points, about a third percent. The S&P 500 climbed 5 points. That is a quarter of 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.